My Lai is more than a battlefield tragedy. My Lai is more than the subject of several well-publicized criminal trials. The very word My Lai is synonymous with battlefield atrocity. Within the context of the Vietnam era, it may have well been the turning point in an unpopular war and may well be a high watermark in the cultural war that befell our country in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Retired Army Colonel William George Eckert, Army Judge Advocate General's Corps, is currently a clinical professor of law emeritus, University of Missouri Kansas City School of Law. Bill Eckert served as chief trial counsel and government representative in the My Lai court martial cases, and today we are honored to hear his story.
Welcome to the Bull Simons Op Center podcast, where warriors share their stories about key events in military history. Arthur D. Bull Simons was a legendary Special Forces soldier who is famous for leading the San Tae raid into North Vietnam in November 1970 to rescue American POWs. The Bull Simons Op Center is a program of the nonprofit Simons Center for Ethical Leadership and Interagency Cooperation on Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
All right, welcome everybody. Today we're honored to be talking with Colonel William George Eckert, U.S. Army retired, Army Judge Advocate General's Corps, who was the Chief Trial Counsel and Government Representative in the My Lai court-martial cases. So, Bill, thank you for being here. You've got a phenomenal experience and a phenomenal story to share with us. I would like to go back and tell us about what you had done in your Army career up until the point where you ended up on the My Lai case.
Colonel Carlin, thank you so much for having me. I'm a proud founding trustee of the Army Command and General Staff College, and it is an honor to participate in a program under the sponsorship of the Simons Centers, which honors one of our special heroes, Special Forces Colonel Bill Bull Simon, of Vietnam San Tae raid fame. It's a delight to be here. Well, Joe, I have the privilege of having a foot in two professions. I began my military career as an ROTC cadet, a colonel, a distinguished military graduate, commissioned in the regular Army and the infantry, sent immediately to the University of Virginia School of Law on the excess leave program. I'm a distinguished graduate of that law school and was in Vietnam within 90 days after I graduated by my choice, assigned to the largest court-martial jurisdiction in the history of the Army. It was 50,000 in World War II, and it was 150,000 at this particular era, and six of us tried all the cases. I need to add that I was so impressed with the professionalism that I witnessed that I decided to make the Army a career after that year in Vietnam. I was a courts martial trial lawyer in Vietnam and in Germany and at My Lai. After that, I became a Pentagon action officer for constitutional litigation in the federal courts involving Vietnam, largely the dissent issues that were in the federal courts involving that particular war. Like many Army officers, I was a staff judge advocate at the Presidio of San Francisco and in the 3rd Armored Division in Europe. Military education is fairly standard. The JAG career course was at the Command and General Staff College, was at the Army War College, where I held the Dwight David Eisenhower Chair of National Security. Most military officers end up teaching, as I did, ROTC cadets at the University of California at Berkeley, where I was spat upon every day I walked to class, Command and General Staff College, where we students were required to teach a course rather than take one. So that was the trade-off, I guess. And then the chair at the War College. And my senior positions were the Army's Chief Appellate Defender, and had the honor of filing the first brief in the Supreme Court on behalf of soldiers and under the Military Justice Act of 1983, and by George, won it. So teaching at the War College, and then, importantly, being a legal advisor to a combatant sink in the first Gulf War. So I guess the whole purpose of that is to say I'm no stranger to battlefield legal issues.
Wow. quite the career. What, out of curiosity, I do have one quick question. When you're at UC Berkeley, what years were this, was that?
That was in the late 70s.
Really? Even in the late 70s, it was still going on?
No, it was still going on. And that pretty unhappy time.
Yeah.
But I would say that with my incredibly bright students and throughout that entire process, you know, teachers learn as much when they teach as they teach. And my dealing with those students probably did more to help me deal with military officers and others, because I had to teach military law to non-lawyers and had to, for the first time, deal with that. Mm. So I found that to be personally enriching, although I didn't like being spat upon.
Yeah, nobody does. Wow, thanks for sharing that. So where were you at in your career as far as rank and current job description you were in when the Milei case came up?
When the Milei cases came up, I was a senior captain in the career course. Mm-hmm. And Joe, they yanked me out of there. Didn't really tell me whether I was going to finish. Really? I had to work hard to be sure that my thesis wasn't destroyed. And off to Fort McPherson I went on 1 week's notice. Boom, boom, boom.
No kidding. You were specially chosen for this.
I think so, yes.
Really?
Of course, I couldn't tell you why, but that was, I think it's because my experience in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Two incidents that the historians tell me are significant in the Vietnam era when it comes to military justice. One of them is the incident on Hill 192, or casualties of war. Mm-hmm. First Cav case, capital case involving a rape murder. Awful. I defended the ringleader in that, and it's the subject of a book and a nonfiction novel, et cetera. And then it's the Milei case. So those are the two, and I suspect it's the predicate of that, and then some trial work in Germany that they very courteously allowed me to decline. Those who in the history have accepted these sort of things have always had political difficulty. I guess is the best way to say it. And they very candidly said, you know, are you willing to do this? And I said, yes.
Wow. Can you lay the battlefield out for us? Some of the circumstances leading up to this, for instance, a lot of people may not realize this, but the Milei case didn't actually come up until like about a year after it actually occurred.
Let me move in to this and talk a little bit about why we should even talk about such a horrible incident. Mm-hmm. I think especially, and I think we talk about it because this is not an exercise in self-flagellation. I mean, that's not what we're doing. We're trying to learn from the past to prevent in the future. And I think the very fact that we discuss this, we're underlying the proud tradition of the profession of arms in our nation when we deal with how we react to the rule of law and responsible command is absolutely the heart of the military profession. And that's what we're really discussing today, even though we're using a very horrible, horrible incident. But there's an overview that I think is necessary when we talk about this. There are two incidents that occurred 90 days apart in Vietnam, in the same general area, totally different effects on public opinion. The first is Milei, which was the American forces. And basically, as we're going to get to rather quickly, it was a unit out of control. And tragically, when units get out of control, in 2 hours, 500 people died. That's just awful. Mm-hmm. But it is not the result of government policy. But boy, did it have a negative effect on American public opinion.
Yeah.
Now, within 90 days of this happening, the Viet Cong entered Hue in the 1968 Tet Offensive. They entered it with 12,000 troops. They entered it with a list of people that were to be killed. They captured, they rounded up at least 5,800 of them, and we have about 2,800 of their bodies, where the government systematically took a list and went and executed people. Mm. This conduct was so extreme that it is reported to have put all sorts of backbone into the Vietnamese in their defense. They realized they couldn't negotiate if their people were going to behave that way. So I think that it's sort of necessary to put that in. But even then, when we're talking about this particular incident, I just want to ask you some questions because I'm not sure what you and I are going to talk about. Well, the first is, what is My Lai? Is it a village in Vietnam? Is it a massacre of 500 civilians by American troops on the 16th of March, 1968? Is it the trials that followed that were front page news for 2 years with two and three times the hype of O.J. Simpson trial? Was it the political turning point in the Vietnam War? Was it used for, it was used for years as a political whip to lash out at the military and the government in general, and boy, were we the recipient of that.
Yep.
Is it a key point in the American Cultural Civil War? But maybe more importantly, is it a catalyst for worldwide progress in professional conduct on the battlefield? And indeed, I think one can make the argument for human rights in general. So I thought it was just pretty essential just to at least figure out what we were talking about. Well, you asked me what happened. So let's sort of turn to what happened. And I want to approach this by generally what happened and then go through some specific problems that I think the public will understand, and it will help amplify what we want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're talking about the Mirakal Division, Task Force Barker, Quang Nai Province, 1968 in March. Unbelievably Viet Cong infested area. No question about that. And there was a briefing. And as a matter of fact, the key to this briefing is an order, which we'll talk about in a minute. But there was a pep talk, an emotional time. And so the next day, they launched this operation, the standard artillery prep. From about 7:30, they landed, they went in, and to be candid, in about 2 hours, 500 people were dead. The incident was not reported. It was indeed covered up. It was exposed by Ron Ridenour in a classic manner. He wrote one of the most articulate letters I've ever read, and he sent it to about 50 people. So the government got this particular letter, and the Army, to its credit, had an inspector general look at it, determined it was criminal, turned it over to the CID. They investigated it, and they charged Calley, and all this was done before Seymour Hersh ever broke the story. So the Army wasn't pressured into doing it. The Army did what it was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
This was was made inflammatory by photographs by Ron Haberle that appeared in Life magazine. And this is not World War II. This is a TV war. And those pictures had profound impact on the American public. There are three main characters in this story. Lieutenant William Calley, who was a platoon leader who probably killed 250 people with his own hands. There's Captain Ernest Medina, who is a company commander subject to his command responsibility and order. And then there was the hero of all this, which is Hugh Thompson, who was the intervener who is the one I think we ought to remember about My Lai. So those are your three characters. So the bottom line is the facts were always controversial. They always will be. But there's no doubt that troops got on the ground, and even Captain Medina said they got out of control. So I think that's the best way to describe it. They got out of control and 500 people died. So let's go to the problems that I see it. And I think that'll give some substance to that synthesis of facts.
Mm-hmm.
The order issue, which deals with Captain Medina's responsibility, which deals with whether the government's culpability. So in this particular instance, it's agreed there was a pep talk. He ordered them, in the strangest order I've ever saw, to destroy all the crops, kill the livestock, burn all houses, pollute the water wells, and he gave no instructions for safeguarding civilians. Now, the question became, what in the disagreement was there an order to kill non-combatants? That was the issue. Mm-hmm. And things evolved because Captain Medina was charged with issuing the order and being a principal. Well, when I got in and started to talking to everybody, the bottom line is only about 20% of the soldiers shot. The rest of them said, oh, Major Eckhart, there was no reason to shoot. I didn't shoot. So 80% of them never fired a shot. There wasn't any reason.
Right.
So the only people who said they obeyed orders were the ones that had blood on their hands and needed the defense of obedience to orders is the bottom line. So what did we do? Well, sometimes things happen. F. Lee Bailey requested a polygraph exam. Shook up official Washington, but we did it. Did it over 4 days. Did it getting the answer to six questions. And according to the order, and this is significant, Captain Medina was truthful when he said, and my words are careful, he did not intentionally infer to his men that they were to kill unarmed, unresisting noncombatants. Mm-hmm. That's significant for the honor of the United States, I think.
Yeah.
Secondly, however, we did a peak of tension test to see when he knew. And there's a disconnect here between his oral confession, which you test on a polygraph, and his polygraph results. When we came, we did 90-minute time sequences. Did you know that your men were killing unarmed, unresisting noncombatants? So we did it the day before, the day of, and into the next day. When it got to 7:30 to 9 o'clock, he didn't react. Joe, he went off the chart.
Really?
Then he told us orally, which is the only thing we could legitimately use, that he didn't know until he saw a group of bodies about 10:20, and that he issued a ceasefire order at 10:30. And that's the way the facts went to the court. So what we learned from that is that he did not intentionally infer. Now, the order becomes important when you deal with someone like Callie. So what do we do with obedience to orders? Well, that's not really that hard a problem, particularly in the military, because when you have that question, presumably you have experienced combat veterans who are going to listen to the evidence and make a determination. That's key. Mm-hmm. But there are three parts to this that are fairly simple. Did the soldier receive an illegal order? In Callie's case, you had Callie said he got this order and Medina said he didn't. That dispute was resolved. So if the jury decided he didn't receive an order, then he didn't have a defense. But even if they decided he did receive the order, the two other parts there, is the order legal? And that's right. A judge question. And killing unarmed, unresisting noncombatants under one's control is just simply illegal. And the judge did that. Now the question becomes, does the soldier have actual knowledge or should he have knowledge of a person of ordinary sense and understanding? And I think no lieutenant in the Army thinks that it's legal to bayonet babies and bayonet priests and kill that many people, and order that many people killed.
Right.
So that's sort of what the issue of the order thing in the Callie trial. Now, the ethical difficulty in this came with the prosecution of former servicemen. This wasn't discovered for a year. And you in this time of the Army, it was a two-year Army. It sort of recycled itself.
Yeah.
So that by the time we came to prosecute, 90% of all the people who were involved in this were out of the Army.
Right. And so one of the names you mentioned earlier, actually the guy who started the whole investigation, Mr. Ridenour, I believe was his name?
Uh-huh, Ron Ridenour.
Was he, where was he at during the My Lai incident? Was he in the platoon with Lieutenant Callie?
He was friends with some of the people who were there. And soldiers talked, and
he wasn't even there himself.
No.
Okay.
Of course, the photographer was, And he's the one that surreptitiously, to the Army's horror, took those pictures.
Wow. Okay.
But you have hotlines in the military. Mm-hmm. This was a classic use of that sort of mail. This was done by mail, but the way we correct ourselves when all of a sudden out of the clear blue you get an allegation of something that's, and you don't sweep that under the rug, you take a look at it, and that's exactly what the military did in textbook fashion.
Interesting, yeah.
But the problem with former servicemen was that, I'm going to have to get a little legal here, but hopefully not very legal. After the Nuremberg trials in World War II, Congress gave a system for prosecuting these sorts of incidents, which unfortunately in the Supreme Court of the United States struck down because former servicemen didn't have a right to grand jury, and they thought that was detrimental to rights. So the military was precluded from prosecuting former servicemen. Therefore, we couldn't go after anybody that was out. There were some other ways it could have been done, but the Attorney General and others decided, and the President decided not to do that. So we were left with the 10% were there, and what you had to do legally and morally to go after them, made some awful decisions. So you're really going to grant immunity to someone who killed 25 people to convict a soldier who, at the same time, in anguish with tears rolling down his cheeks, put someone out of their misery? I think not. But those sorts of things are horrible. And that was a consequence of that. One of the big lessons from all this, that the whole reason perhaps for doing some of this, is the importance of command responsibility, the duty to control troops. You know, we're privileged as profession of arms. We have one of the highest duties is to control troops. And it is so important that the execution of that, or the failure to execute that, makes service people responsible for being criminally prosecuted for inaction. Now, not even doctors, nobody else, because of the importance of that. So what are we talking about? Well, it's pretty simple. It's just basically enforcement of military discipline, the duty to control your troops. Presumably there has to be knowledge, actual or imputed, that a commander knows that something, or a non-commissioned officer knows that something is amiss. And then he has to have the ability to do something about it. And these people have to be under his, have to be required to respond to him. But you don't do that.
That's right.
You've not only dishonored the profession, you've done something criminal. And all of that, for the first time, I think, sort of bubbled up in this particular incident.
Yes. Bill, we're gonna take a quick break. So hold that thought, and we'll be right back.
The U.S. Army Commander General Staff College on Fort Leavenworth celebrates its 140th anniversary in 2021. It was founded by General William Tecumseh Sherman in 1881 as the School for the Application of Cavalry and Infantry. The CGSC Foundation supports the development of leaders of character and competence at the college for ethical service to the nation in three general areas: scholarship, outreach, and soldiers and family support. You can contribute to the Margin of Excellence by making a tax-exempt contribution through our website at cgscf.org/donate. That's cgscf.org/donate.
All right, back talking with Colonel Bill Eckert, U.S. Army retired Army Judge Advocate General's Corps, talking about the My Lai case in Vietnam. So, Bill, before the break, we were just getting started with the court case. How was it that the American public, how did the American public's opinion and interference almost in the case affect everything?
Profoundly, in a word. But we lost the battle, if you will, with public opinion, because the public began to put pressure on all of our witnesses not to remember or not to cooperate. And the cooperation and the testimony of our witnesses just went downhill from there.
Now, what do you mean by that? That your witnesses they were put, witnesses were put under pressure to not remember, yes. not remember the atrocity, or not remember that it wasn't as bad as.
Oh, they can bring you into court, but all you have to say is, "I don't remember," and you're off the hook, is what they were being whispered in their ear.
By the American public?
Yes. When we go on, the American public was absolutely was not behind the particular prosecution. We had it was so bad that my mentor said that our prosecutorial record, which was pretty awful, only Callie was convicted, and he was convicted because he killed 250 people, and there were enough witnesses. Yeah. But the others just evaporated. And not only there, but it evaporated on other issues. So there were other companies involved in the task force that I was responsible for. And the instant all the publicity came out, that information just dried up.
And that surprises me, Bill, because at the time, the American public didn't have a real favorable opinion of what was going on in Vietnam. So I would think that the American public would have swayed people to remember and help with the prosecution.
No, at that time it was a slap in the face of the war effort. Who ever heard of doing this? Total misunderstanding of what we were trying to do, to be blunt.
Mm-hmm.
President, let's just look at some of the things. President Nixon intervened after Callie was convicted, tarnished the hard-earned conviction, cut his sentence dramatically, refused to send him to Leavenworth.
Mm-hmm.
The drama went on for a while. The federal judge who in the Georgia district where Callie was actually brought the defense counsel in there and says, "Why don't you sue the United States? Why do you think we had our federal thing?" And when you see how this was, after Callie was convicted, Governor Carter and George Wallace in Alabama wanted to make Callie an honorary lieutenant colonel in the National Guard. Holy now, God. You can't get much more headwind than that. The President Nixon actually had a task force to discredit Hugh Thompson, and they. I'm going to talk about Congress in a minute, but Mr. Hebert took our hero, Hugh Thompson, and took him on the steps of the White House and browbeat him with an inch of his life on public television.
Hey, Hugh Thompson, was he the warrant officer?
He was a warrant officer that...
the pilot.
Pilot, and I'm going to talk extensively about what he did, because what he did received... His award ceremony at the end, when the government agreed with the government's facts, and the whole incident of My Lai ended with a switch from the villain of Lieutenant Callie to the hero ship of Hugh Thompson, and I'm moving in that direction, I think.
Wow. Okay.
But Congress, for instance, decided that it was not in the interest of the United States to prosecute these cases, so that it used what I call the Jinx Act, which is very just fairness. If the defense is entitled to see all the statements that any witness has made prior to trial, so it can effectively cross-examination. That's just, since the 40s, that's what's happened.
Right.
Well, Congress knew that. So what they did, calculatingly, publicly so stated, was to call every single witness in the My Lai incident, cover up, et cetera, get their testimony, and then gave it a congressional classification and refused to give it to the executive so we could use it. So we started our first case with the judge not letting any of our witnesses testify who had testified in front of Congress, and we, of course, lost the first case, and we had to scrap from there on. So my whole point in this series of things is that, pretty awful public and public reaction.
Hmm.
Stop. One anecdote that might be, while we're on that, that might be interesting is one night, General Pierce, who in the Pierce report, he's the lieutenant general who did the extensive report on My Lai, that is just a classic. And he was speaking where I was a staff judge advocate at the Presidio of San Francisco. And I'll tell you, when those of us get talking about this, the adrenaline flows, and I suppose you can even tell from my demeanor and even my voice that it flows.
Yes.
Well, he was in the same way. And so he finished. Wouldn't believe this. His brigadier general in the back stood up, and he said, if we had only known. And I thought he was going to snap his head off. He said, how can you not read the newspapers? How can you not see what's going on and not understand what was going on? And he just chewed him out. And I think that may be the epitome of the public part of this. Huh. Well, sometimes things have even a better end. So the ending of all this, it was as peculiar as a beginning. And it began with Hugh Thompson, who when he got the Soldier's Medal. And he got it on the 6th of March in 1998 at the Vietnam Memorial. And it was the 30th anniversary of My Lai. As the editor, as the headline said in the Washington Post, 30 years later, heroes emerge from the shame of the My Lai massacre.
Wow.
Strangest, Hugh Thompson called me, Joe, and he said, could I come to his award ceremony? It's going to be in Washington, D.C. Well, I'm teaching. So I think providentially, all of a sudden, I found myself there. So he said, come sit with my family. He said, where's it going to be? And he said, well, it's going to be at the Vietnam Memorial. I said, well, you don't have award ceremonies at the Vietnam Memorial. And he says, well, this one's there. And I said, all right. So I went at 11 o'clock, and the Army band's playing, and there's a circle of 80 flags around this circle up here, and there are a bunch of chairs there, and there are probably 15 or so lieutenant generals sitting over there, and the limousines come up, and the elderly, shall I say, chairman of the various committees get out of the cars, and we had quite a gathering. So it started off with a prayer by the chaplain, which was printed ad hoc verba in the New York Times the next day. You don't have many invocations make the New York Times.
Right.
That started then. The person who presided over this was Brigadier General Michael Ackerman. And I taught him. He was a good, fine officer. And so after this, he gave about a 10 or 15 minute lecture, if you will, I would even say sermon, on the need for professional conduct on the battlefield. And then it came time to read the citation and present the award. Well, Joe, when they read the citation, which is the first time I'd heard of it, I almost fell off the chair. Because if I had uttered those words as a prosecutor in the early days, I would have been booed, hissed, and cursed and spat on. Things changed that much.
Yeah.
So it ended with Hugh Thompson standing up, and the tears were rolling down his cheeks, and he fairly shouted in an emotional voice, this is for those of you who did it right, meaning follow the rules and were professional.
Right.
Whereupon this group of sullen audience that didn't want to be there, have anything to do with this incident anymore, were on their feet, they were cheering, and they were yelling. So we finished this particular thing, and I got up with the family and went up to congratulate him. And I don't know why I did this, but here I am. You know, I'm a law professor, and I'm not in uniform or anything. But when I saw him, I took a step back and saluted. He burst into tears, just sobbing. And he went over, and he gave me this big bear hug. Well, that was a little too much for the real presider at this, which was the chief of staff, General Reimer.
Yeah.
So he sent General Ackerman over to see what the devil was going on. So I explained to him that I saluted him because I thought Hugh Thompson showed more courage, what he suffered after this, to do what every good witness has to do without equivocation, without tell what happened.
Right.
He was silenced in the military for years. He'd walk in a bar and everybody would walk out. Mm. He had the courage to do all of that. And so I saluted him. And so General Reimer and I sat there, watched this spectacle for about 10 minutes, just simple, nobody, no strap hangers or anything. Now, what happened because of that is the military, in their ethics teaching, in their ethics manual, all of a sudden started talking about the Hugh Thompson, who had the courage to intervene, had the courage to land his helicopter, had the courage to point his guns at the lieutenant, i.e. Calley, who had the courage to go get people out of a bunker, save their lives, fly them out, lift off, see all these bodies in the ditch, mm-hmm. land, take out this kid who wasn't fatally killed, fly him to a hospital, and more important, with the tears streaming down his cheeks, pounding the table, he says, stop the killing. And they stopped it. So that's the other side of this, and that's sort of the way it ended.
And I would like to point out, while I was reading this ahead of time, he was a Huey pilot and just happened to be circling overhead and saw it and landed and then went over and confronted Lieutenant Calley. And that's how the whole thing, being a helicopter pilot myself, I just wanted to emphasize that part of, that's how he saw it, was he was circling overhead in the Huey and landed and then intervened on the ground. Pretty crazy.
Those of us who teach and have taught for years, whether it's lawyers or whether it's army officers, the importance of ethics, particularly in the military, you do it for the one time in a career, maybe within a minute or so, when somebody like Hugh Thompson sees something and has to do something.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is all about. And that's what we need to reinforce. And he's therefore is a hero, because what's the lesson of Mi Lai? Act like Hugh Thompson. It's that simple. And I get rather emotional about that, but that's the whole purpose of what we did.
Right. Can you cover the specifics of the convictions or the acquittals as they went down?
There were the only person who was convicted was Lieutenant Calley.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Sergeant Hutto that we tried that was acquitted. By this time in this process, he'd confessed. You can't use a confession unless you prove that there was a crime committed. So we clearly proved that, and they admitted the confession, and the jury acquitted. Not going to criticize them, but I suspect at that juncture, with all of the people who were getting off, they're not going to send a sergeant to jail.
Right.
Sometimes that just happens.
Yeah.
The most shocking one to me was Captain Katush, and Mi Lai didn't end with those 2 hours. It got worse. They interrogated Viet Cong, and Captain Katush was the intelligence officer, and according to him, the knife slipped and he cut off a finger of a Viet Cong. And so we charged him. Captain Medina shot over the head of someone. Mm-hmm. But after that interrogation and those and others, Captain Katush would point to the sky and this Vietnamese police would shoot them. Not very pleasant.
Right.
But what was even more shocking to me was news media that mocked me personally for wasting the time of everybody over the finger of a Viet Cong. Totally missed the picture.
Yeah.
Haven't we come a long way? Haven't we come a long way since that, which is the whole purpose of the exercise. But that we were responsible on the ground action. There was a whole other instance of Koster and others with covering up. But there were about 8 other cases that we were responsible for. And when the witnesses dried up and we couldn't produce a prima facie case, they were dismissed. I will tell you that we took special care. There were going to be no cover-ups. Every one of these was done extensively with a record, mm-hmm. but that's a pretty horrible, horrible record. But when I get discouraged about that, I think, as I mentioned before, my mentor says, Bill, it was never the abysmal record, and it is abysmal, but it's amazing how far we got. And right. Can you, for me right now, can you imagine what it would have been like not to have this fight, what it would have done to have covered this up and swept it under the rug and not done everything you could do to see that it never happened again and it was learned from and corrected? And I am so proud mm-hmm. of being a part of the group that, and it wouldn't be a lot of other people that worked so hard to see that happened.
Yeah. Because it's interesting because I think a lot of people's, you know, it's been a long time now, but there's a lot of perception, and this is a very famous story at this point. I think there's a lot of people that misconstrued that it was the Army or the military trying to cover it up and the public was trying to bring it out. But as you say, it was actually the opposite. The military was trying to do the right thing for what was essentially a massacre. Prosecute those involved in it, and it was the public that was going the other way with it.
Well, there was a lot of ignorance about what we professionals do on the battlefield.
Yeah,
pronounced yeah. in the public, but I will tell you, not it was also present in the military as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go through a bunch of dirty laundry, but it's the same. The same thing, who simply did not understand what was going on.
Right. Interesting. Bill, we are getting towards the end of our time here. Not that we're necessarily done, but what are some final thoughts and other lessons learned as we move decades beyond My Lai?
Well, I think it's important when you do something like this, that you have a practical answer for every soldier in the room. And I think the practical answer is the practical prophylactics are your professional training. Have confidence in your professional training. Number two, I think you soldiers need to know and understand and enforce compliance with the rules of engagement. And rules of engagement are nothing more than those matters that usually that are been thought about ahead of going into combat and are sort of one step more than what you would do in your normal training. And it's important that they be crafted carefully so that they allow the command authority to control, but don't tie a soldier's hands behind his back.
Right.
And then I think that it's important to insist on compliance with standard operating procedures, because I can tell you when you're being shot at, it's not necessarily rational. you do what you were instinctively trained to do.
Absolutely.
But as we talked about, the other thing is control of subordinates, clear, concise orders, intervening at the first sign of ill discipline. That's just absolutely necessary. And then, yes, the last is not altruistic. Insist as a commander upon and a non-commissioned officer upon the truthful moral high road. Set the tone. And I think this tragedy, that's at least for a soldier at the tactical level, is what comes out.
Interesting.
We could discuss, awesome. I have some strategic lessons, but I'm not sure that that's what we need to talk about now.
We could probably go on for hours, you know.
Yep.
Yeah. Little off subject. Did you ever have any interaction with Bull Simons or knew of him or cross paths with him any time your career's in the Army?
I did not, but I will tell you that my admiration for the special forces knows no bounds. Mm. My working with them in Vietnam, my working with them at the upper levels in Europe later, mm-hmm. Just profound respect. And I will tell you, in my teaching at the War College, when I taught one of the first courses on command criminal responsibility and dealing with a responsible command, my best officers were special forces officers whose intellect is far and above the average. And I... it's the sort of heroism that Bull Simons epitomizes that I think is worthy of all our respect and those that labor so hard in the vineyards that follow him.
Absolutely. Well said. Well, sir, it's been phenomenal listening to your story. Thank you for sharing your personal experiences on such a just vitally important aspect of an incident that occurred that still everybody refers to Mili when you're talking about rules of engagement nowadays. And regardless of what happened in the prosecution or acquittals, I think what you did and what your team did has had reverberation throughout the U.S. military, even to this day, on how we conduct ourselves on the battlefield.
Thank you. The pleasure has been mine, and the honor of the United States of America and its service persons are most meaningful.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you for listening to the Bull Simons Ops Center podcast. The Simons Center is a program of the Command and General Staff College Foundation, a nonprofit that supports scholarship, outreach, and soldier and family support on Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. We operate entirely on the generosity of our donors. To support the Bull Simons Ops Center, go to thesimonscenter.org and click on the donate button. We welcome support at any level.